work session, joint city council work session. Normally we do roll call, we just do self-introduction. I'm Jim Patrick, Chair of the Planning Commission.
Bob Berman, Planning Commission.
Jerry Tokosi, Newport Community Development.
Beth Goodman, Echo Northwest, your consultant on this.
Ben Knievel, City Manager.
Bill Reinigan, Vice Chairman of the Planning Commission.
Gary East, Planning Commission.
Jane Kaplan, City Council.
Ryan, City Council.
CM Hall, City Council.
Annie McGreenry, I'm on the Advisory Committee for the Planning Commission.
Dave Margoglou, City Council.
Grolio Escobar, Planning Commission.
Sheila Stiley, Executive Director, Northwest Coastal Housing.
John Updike, Planning Commission.
Okay.
Do we have anybody on the?
Yeah.
Cynthia, not on?
Well, there were.
She said, I talked to her this morning, she was considering zooming in.
Yeah, that's what she had told me.
And then Council Mateo Salgado said she was busy at the church and wasn't able to make it.
Okay.
And where's Dean?
He's at the.
He's in Kansas City.
National.
At National Mayor's Conference or whatever.
No, it's the.
National League of Cities.
Cities, the league pays for a certain number of the league trustees to go each year, and this was apparently his turn to go, so.
Good.
Did he go to the Chiefs game on Sunday? I don't know. Said if they're playing the Rams, he would have, but.
Anyway, first up, discussion item is housing capacity analysis component of the Newport Housing Study. Staff report.
Jim Patrick, did you want to go ahead and we did receive one?
Oh, yeah, I do want to acknowledge we did get a email from, second, and I'll tell you who. They wanted it read into the record, but we really don't have time to read it into the record. But it should have been in your packets and will be forwarded to you from the Agate Beach Safety Coalition. Basically talking about the fact that Newport only has three ways out, so.
Does it legally have to be read into the record?
It's a work session.
It's a work session, not a, it's a hearing, I'd be reading it into the record. And it's a work session and we'd be lucky to get through this whole thing, so. All right, staff report.
Thank you. I'll start briefly. Derek Tokos, Community Development Director. And yeah, for work session, we have 1 hour and probably taking the full hour. This work session, this joint work session with the Planning Commission and City Council was scheduled to review part one of two parts of the housing study. This one's called the Housing Capacity Analysis, but it's a technical document. It would be followed by what we call a Housing Production Strategy, which will be a policy document. The Housing Advisory Committee, Sheila's one of our members, has just started to work on the policy piece of that, and we'll be working on that for the next 6 months.
Derek, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but Counselor Jacoby has just texted me and is requesting the Zoom ID. So I just want to make sure she.
I'll send it to her.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, continue, please.
So we have the housing capacity analysis, which is the technical piece of this, which gets at, you know, what is our anticipated housing need over the next 20 years? What kind of buildable lands do we have? And how constructible are those buildable lands? And this information will be used to inform then the policy discussion about what do we need to do policy-wise to help facilitate the construction of needed housing, that being housing that covers the full gamut from housing for those who are currently homeless, all the way up to high-end housing. We have an obligation to meet all of those needs along the spectrum. And so the part two conversation is really going to be going through, okay, what have we been doing? What have we implemented over the years? What of those has really been successful and we want to keep doing? Which of those maybe we want to adjust or change? And which things should we be adding that we're not currently doing? That conversation has just started with the advisory committee, and that'll be a part two that's brought forward. But this technical piece is one that, given the way the state drafted its law and this grant that's partially funding this work is structured, we need to initiate adoption of the technical piece this year. And so we're getting towards the end of the year. We want to get that piece started through an adoption process. Before we get too far in that, we wanted to give you guys a chance to take a look at it, just as the advisory committee's had a chance to take a look at it and get a better understanding and sense of kind of what the projections are calling for and what our buildable land situation looks like and things of that nature. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Beth Goodman with Eco Northwest to kind of walk through these topics. And then we'll try to make sure we reserve a reasonable amount of time for questions.
Okay, and so should I walk through this, Derek, and take questions at the end?
I think that might be the most efficient way to do it, given the limited time we have, is to kind of go through the presentation and then take questions.
Okay, if there's any question about my understandability, because I didn't say something clearly, I'd like people just to tell me if they don't understand the words I said. And otherwise, I'll answer your questions at the end of the presentation. So next slide, please.
And Beth, pardon the interruption, but Councilor Jacoby just entered the meeting as well.
Certainly. So what we're trying to do with this study is answer some basic questions. How much growth is Newport reasonably expecting over the next 20 years? How much buildable land do you have that is vacant and unconstrained? Does Newport have enough buildable land to accommodate expected residential growth? And then the lead on after this is what policies are needed to meet Newport's housing needs. So this project helps establish what Newport's housing needs are. Next slide, please. So the parts of this project, as Derek just said, the dark blue is what we're talking about tonight. It's the housing capacity analysis. It has information from all those bullets in it. The housing production strategies is really going to be the, so what do we do about the unmet housing needs that are in Newport? Next slide, please. So the outcomes of this are effectively what you'd expect. They're the forecast of new housing growth and land need, the inventory of buildable land, identification of housing need both by income level and demographic analysis, and identification of unmet housing needs. Next slide, please. So throughout this project, we've started on a certain amount of engagement. So we've got our project advisory committee, where we've had several meetings of that advisory committee. They've been helping us do outreach with certain communities that are more difficult to reach through the Newport housing conversations. We're still in the process of working on that. We'll have a couple of public events that'll be focused more on the results of the housing production strategies and the strategies that we're getting to out of that. We're not quite there yet. A number of interviews, again, reaching out to people who are harder to reach, and then also to some developers, which we've done some of those interviews at this point to help develop this product, and then a number of meetings with the Planning Commission and the City Council. So in the key stakeholders, we're looking at underrepresented community members, developers, both affordable and market rate developers. We'll be talking to service providers, and then you all elected and appointed officials. So next slide. We are about a little more than, I just call it just slightly over 50% of the way through the project. You can see here we are in November. The orange slides, the orange bits are the upcoming PAC meetings that we've got. As well as some City Council and Planning Commission meetings that will be going on in through the beginning of the next year. So next slide, please. We expect to have this project finished up by May.
You can follow at your leisure.
Any questions before I go on? Sorry, Project Advisory Committee. Little brain, lots of acronyms.
So fun fact, that greenhouse that used to be gray, it's been sold twice, and each owner has made $100,000 off the top since that house was initially
built. That's a good example. I took
one move because they didn't want to be my neighbor, for the record.
I've heard that a lot.
I'm sure you have, Bob.
So next slide, please. Talking about housing needs, there's a lot of information in the housing capacity analysis report about housing needs. We're just trying to skim over the top here. So about 40% of Newport's households are said to be cost burdened, meaning that they're spending
30% or more of their gross income on housing costs. And about half of those, 20%, are severely cost burdened, meaning that they're spending 50% or more of their income on housing costs. You see that 53% of renters are cost burdened, 27% of whom are severely cost burdened. So your renters are in a lot of trouble, and more than a quarter of your renters are in big trouble, essentially, in terms of affording housing.
Those statistics were from?
They're from the U.S. Census.
Census data, okay.
And they are across the 16 to 20 time period, so the most recent data.
So you're saying only 28% of the population here is own houses?
No, we're saying 28% of owners 28% of owners are cost burdened. Your ownership statistics are in the report, and it's considerably higher than that. More than 60% of your households are owner occupied. So next slide, please. So when we look at cost burden by different income levels, what you see isn't really surprising. Your lower income households have higher rates of cost burden. So for renter households, those earning below $35,000, about 80% of those households are cost burdened. You see a similar pattern for ownership households, where cost burden is very high for homeowners with income below $20,000. Drops off a little bit more as you get higher incomes. But what you're seeing for all lower income households, you're seeing a lot of cost burden. So next slide. So as we're thinking about housing need in the future, as well as in the current state, it's helpful to think about housing need and how it differs by different income levels and who produces housing that's affordable at those income levels. So your households earning 50% or less, well, let's start with median family income. Median family income for Lincoln County is about $57,000, and that's for a household of four. A household that earns $57,000 can afford about $1,400 a month in rent. And a house up to $230,000. I'm sure that there's not many of those at all in Newport. So when you look at lower income households, earning 50% or less of median family income, they're earning about $28,700, and they can afford about $720 in rent. Housing that's newly developed for these households in that income level typically or almost always is income-restricted housing. So it's housing that has federal and state funding in it generally, and it's often built by nonprofit organizations like Sheila's organization. You don't find private developers building housing that's affordable in that range very often at all. It's hard to get housing that's in that range, affordable range, developed. Now, when you look at middle-income households, so those earning between about 60% of median family income up to 100 to 120% of median family income, housing for those households is typically built by market rate developers. When you're talking in the lower part of that income range, so below 80% of median family income, or about $46,000 of income, you're looking at rents that are about $1,150 a month. You don't get housing that's built, newly built, in those income ranges very often at all. And when you do, it's built, generally speaking, with some sort of public subsidy in it, like using the multi-unit property tax exemption, for instance. It's very hard to get housing built in that income range. Now, if you look at your average monthly rent, this isn't including utilities, but it's about $1,360 a month on average. When you put utilities in there, it goes up to about $1,600 a month, you know, on average. So a household has to earn at least 100% of median family income, if not a little bit more than that, to afford that housing without being cost burdened. And newly built housing is more likely to have housing prices at or above that level. When you look at median home values, Earlier in the year, we were looking at median home values of about $400,000. That's what we were seeing. And a household has to earn about 186% of median family income to afford that. So your toppest in household, that's where you're getting that kind of development and that kind of affordability. If you go into the next slide.
Can I ask a question real quick?
Sure.
Is that 68 grand per year for elementary school teacher? That's not in this school district, is it?
Well, it's in this county.
Region. An average of
it is an average.
Mid-career, because starting they're paying about 41,
mm-hmm.
which is why they're hiring people with no qualifications to teach now, because the salary is too low.
We're getting that information from the Bureau of Labor Statistics,
okay.
either for Lincoln County or the region that includes Lincoln County.
So it's a generalization.
It is a generalization. Yeah. It is pointing out that you have many working households at mid and low income areas. So
this is based on single income family?
This is a four. It's hard to say exactly what it's based on, because it's not based on one income family and it's not based on two. It'll be based on the average, which is probably somewhere about 1.2 to 1.4 working persons per household. So, yes, sir.
Have you thought about how all these numbers might change given the dramatic increase in mortgage rates recently?
Yes.
I know this was all prepared probably before that.
Yes. And so, can I go into the next slide?
Sure.
Let me go into a few slides.
Just a thought.
I've got it in just a couple slides. So this slide shows you the people in those income brackets. So for instance, about 33% of your community has income below $29,000. So those lowest two bars. And about 33% of your community, oddly enough, is in that middle income, from low and middle income. And then about a third of your community is in that high income. So if you think about most new housing that's being built, it's going to be built, especially single family ownership housing, affordable in the top part of that 33%. So affordable to people who earn well over the median household income. And I will get to your question about, and does this get any better from this? And the answer is no. So you've got, I'm Miss Optimism here. So you've got your income groups very oddly evenly distributed among these household incomes. So remember, as I were talking about this going forward, the lower two bars there, those 33% for new and existing households, that's going to be built by nonprofit organizations, your housing authority, that kind of thing. That middle two bars, those are harder to build and getting, you know, harder and harder to build at that lower part of it, the low income piece. And then newly built housing of the type that you typically see is in that highest income range. I will return to your question. It's just a little bit further on. So next slide, please. So as we're considering this, we're considering housing need by income, but we're also considering housing needs of different groups. So people experiencing homelessness, people of color, people 65 years and older, and people with disabilities. So to generalize about this, because I'm going through this quickly, those four groups, they all need access to housing that's affordable. They all need access to housing without discrimination. And those are our four groups that we see discrimination against fairly commonly, comparatively. And for the bottom three groups, racial and ethnic groups, people over 65 years old and people with disabilities, they are disproportionately cost burdened, meaning that cost burden is higher among those three groups. People experiencing homelessness, they weren't even in the data that we looked at a few minutes ago. So to say they're a cost burden is to understate. They're simply priced out of the housing markets unless they're able to get into income restricted housing. So we're considering those four groups and the special needs, because there are special needs of those four groups as we're developing the housing production strategy. And there's quite a bit of information in the housing needs analysis to support that.
How can you have people who are homeless and then you have a group of them that are sheltered? Could you explain that to us?
So are you asking about the sheltered, unsheltered people mm-hmm. experiencing homelessness? When the point in time count is done, point in time count looks at people who are in any sort of shelter, and it also looks at people who are unsheltered, so living on the streets, essentially.
We don't have a shelter.
This is for the county. This is for Lincoln County. Uh-huh. We're also looking at other information, say from the school district, about students experiencing homelessness, and that can be that they're doubling up on people's couches or living in a hotel or some other temporary sort of measure. Yes, sir.
Do we count, I know there are many families who kind of live with other families in very crowded conditions. They get counted as in the homeless count.
They do not get counted in the homeless count. People who are doubled up with other families, I don't believe are counted in the homeless count. They'd be very hard to find.
Yeah.
The count of people experiencing homelessness, let me explain, is an underestimate. We know this, it's true across the state. It's an underestimate. The best guess is about 1.8 times the people who we know of in the point in time count are actually homeless. So if you figure it's half again as much, then you're getting closer.
Right.
I know. Next slide, please. So now we're going to go look at buildable land, and then we will turn to housing need in a few minutes. So buildable lands inventory. Next slide, please. The steps in the buildable lands inventory, this is a technical piece of work. We start off with GIS data and mapping, and we classify all the parcels in the community into mutually exclusive groups, like vacant or developed. And then we look at all the land that's vacant and we identify constraints. So things like steep slopes, your geologic hazards, I think is one of the constraints. Then you'll also have things like floodway and floodplain and that kind of thing. So anything, land that falls into these constraints, even if it's vacant, is not considered buildable.
Tsunami areas?
Will you remind me of what we decided with the tsunami inundation zone? I think we decided it was not a prohibitive constraint.
Correct.
Yes.
So where we have existing residentially zoned property within a tsunami inundation area, they would be considered buildable.
Yes. We've done a few rounds of verification with this. First with Derek, and then our committee looked at it and any errors they found in the maps. And these are, Newport's such a funny shaped city that it's hard to show the maps. But we've done that verification. And here tonight is the summarization of the results along with, in the report, the summarization of the results. And I'll talk about the constructability analysis as we go through, because that's sort of a special analysis. So next slide. So here we've broken Newport up into three different maps. You see the northern map and the southern map here. And when we go to it, we'll see the middle map. These things are available as PDF files if anybody wants to zoom in and look at particular properties. One thing to note is that the area to the south that is in the planned destination resort overlay, while we have mapped it and we've counted it in here, it's not considered buildable for the sake of this project because of the development requirements for the area mean that if you're going to build a part of it, you have to build all of it. And it was designed for a destination resort, which is not needed housing. Plus, the area is probably, it's very difficult to develop. So next slide, please. And this is your middle area. And we haven't shown you the bay, but you can sort of fill in the bay area in your mind. Next slide, please. What we've got here that is buildable, that includes land that is on vacant lots and then land that is on partially vacant lots. So those are lots where you have, say, one house on a larger parcel of land. What we have is about 1,400 acres of land that is vacant and unconstrained. Once you take out the reserve overlay, that's about 903 acres. A lot of that is near low-density plan designation and zones, and then about 155 acres in your high-density that's outside the plan resort, destination resort overlay, and about 59 acres of commercial. For the sake of this project, we did not consider that all of your commercial land would develop with housing. We considered that about 30% of it might develop with housing, so a portion of it, because of course other types of uses are going to develop in commercial areas as well. Yes, ma'am.
I am asking a question during it, but to that point, like I feel like my sticking point is there is potential in the commercial areas that with so much digitization and things going online and storefronts being online storefronts, I just feel like, do we really need all of these commercial spaces? And so it just makes me feel like there's opportunities there. And you talked about removing constraints and all that, so I'm just trying to get a sense of, has that been taken into account?
It's hard to take that into account to a certain degree, because mm-hmm. in part, it's hard to see. I do comparable studies for commercial and industrial areas. It's hard to see over a 20-year period where that's going to go. You are a community that has an awful lot of tourism, so there's going to continue to be a lot of demand, I think, for commercial land. As you'll see in a few minutes, there's a lot of broad assumptions in this. Newport has a lot of land. A lot of it is hard to build on. So if we're off on commercial, because we've considered about 20 acres of land buildable, and maybe all your commercial is buildable, which is unlikely, but we're off by 40 acres. You guys have so much land, and so much land that is hard to develop, that you'd basically be making up for that 40 acres from somewhere else. And so if you get more development in commercial than expected.
And the 30% of that 59 commercial acres, do you have that marked out where you're thinking those commercial spaces could
no.
be? Okay.
No, you. Absolutely not. Because that would be a level of precision beyond which this cannot go. So next slide, please. So the constructability analysis. This is something that we haven't attempted to do anywhere else, and that Derek wanted us to do, and it's important to do. Because a lot of your land is very hard to develop because it doesn't have infrastructure to it, and it's going to cost millions of dollars to get land to that infrastructure. So what appears to be 900 acres of vacant, unconstrained, buildable land is considerably less than that. So next slide. What we did is we selected 9 different areas throughout the city to essentially look at how much land is in those areas that's vacant and unconstrained, what kind of development is allowed there under current zoning, what if some of the zoning changed a little bit to allow more high-density housing, for instance, and then roughly approximated the infrastructure costs for development of that area. And when I say roughly estimated them, they are really rough estimates, because it's hard to do until you're actually sitting down and doing the engineering, as Derek can tell you, because I think, Derek, you and your engineering staff sat down and developed these costs. So in Area 1, for instance, at the north part of the city, the cost for infrastructure could be between $7 million and $21 million. It was one of the bigger ranges. It depends on what's going to be built there. If it's low density and not very many housing units, less infrastructure will be needed, but it'll be more expensive per dwelling unit. And if it's, you know, a little bit more density, but we're not talking about super high density there, then you'll need more infrastructure to support those dwelling units. So site 3, I also...
So just on site 1, mm-hmm. that cost for infrastructure, is that based on fully developing the what's determined to be buildable sites?
No. It depends. We've got like 3 or 4 different estimates. for Area One, because that was one that could go a lot of different ways. So we estimated, what if it developed with multifamily? What if it developed with sort of a medium density sort of LDR on the hillsides? What if it was really low density LDR and hillsides? There's a lot of different ways that it could have gone, and it's very hard to say which way it would go. But we did look at the most, we looked at is development of all the vacant parcels.
That are buildable?
That are buildable, yeah, so unconstrained.
What is LDR?
Low density residential, I apologize.
Okay.
HDR is high density residential. I'm sorry.
What's the name of an engineering company in town here?
It is the name of an engineering company.
Before.
So like area number three, which is right along Highway 20, right above the bayfront there, the estimate for infrastructure for there is pretty high. It was like $37 million. And so many of these areas are going to be expensive to service. We looked at areas where there was a lot of buildable land comparatively, and where you might have sort of typical infrastructure costs. And so when I say infrastructure, I mean water and sewer and transportation. I don't think we looked at any other infrastructure. Am I right about that, Derek?
The stormwater would have been rolling in the transportation piece.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. So if you go to the next slide.
Wait, can I ask, what's
yes, ma'am.
Number seven?
Number seven?
I can't make it out.
It's a little tiny place. Right off the highway. I don't remember why we picked
that's,
number seven.
That's Herbert between Olive and Third. We wanted to make sure that when we were doing a constructability analysis, we were not just looking at the large undeveloped tracts, but also some opportunity areas where we strategically made some investments in infrastructure in these areas that are underdeveloped that we might realize a meaningful number of housing units of some type. So you've got the infill areas, which seven is an example.
Nine.
I think eight and nine are also examples of that. So we wanted a few of those examples in there.
You mean north of the Legion, where the end of the street end ends? Down
yeah,
to
you
the
got
hill
a little stub street there.
Mm-hmm.
That,
yeah,
you got a little,
yeah.
It goes north up from Olive and it stubs and stops.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a number of vacant properties up there that haven't developed in part because they don't have street access. There's modest sewer line extensions that need to be done, some water line adjustments that need to be done. But see, the other thing is, too, when you're looking at an infill area and you're looking at a small number of units being built, their capacity to pay for infrastructure is less. You look at a large area like one or five, like in Wilder, and you have a large residential phase come in there and it's a large number of units, there's more capacity to absorb infrastructure cost. So that was factored into this.
Yes. Yes, so we looked at cost of infrastructure per buildable acre, essentially, in the summary that we have of this at the very end of the report.
So when we're looking at the green shaded areas, then those are, well, what's representing the buildable residential?
Those green shaded areas are low density. The lighter green shaded, the darker green shaded are high density.
But those are, that's showing buildable lands
yeah.
in those zoning districts.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
Yep, and the reason that you see funny fingers through them and little gaps
the
is the, exactly.
Areas.
So we assumed 40% slope. Anything under 40 would be buildable, over 40% slope. Mm-hmm. And that's generous. I mean, if you're in the valley, you'd be looking at 25% of slope.
It is true.
But we also factored into the infrastructure cost in those where we have terrain issues, particularly up on the north end and on area three between US 20 and Bay Road. We put in a factor, additional cost factor, because of the retaining walls and similar work you have to do to get your infrastructure in on those steep slopes is considerably more expensive than if you're dealing with more gradual slopes.
To follow up on your question, Derek, a slide a couple of slides ago where we talked about how it's 1,400 acres, if you take out the 500 from the plan to station resort, of that roughly 900 some acres 40% of that is buildable?
No.
No.
No. That is all, because it's 40% of buildable.
When we say it's buildable, that means you can expect this.
Or the grade that you're talking about, sorry.
The green color here, so the stuff that's identified as buildable would be under 40% slope. If it's over 40% slope, we ruled it out. It's just too steep.
So it's not counted in that buildable land acreage? Thank you, okay.
Just like if it was under a river, you couldn't.
Under what?
Under a river. Imagine you've got a river flowing over it. You can't build on the bottom of the river unless you want to drown.
You could build on the bottom of the river.
I can't build on the bottom of a river.
We got lots of buildings in the river.
Okay.
We got over the river and
under the river and through the snow.
Under the river, so I put over.
Under the state.
All right, so going on to the next piece. So what we looked at, this is a summary of what we found, is we looked at the value of the land. It's called a residual land value analysis, where the value of the land after accounting for costs of infrastructure and costs of development, where that was higher than the costs. What you see here is that would be financially feasible, theoretically. So what you see here, where you've got the orange diamonds up above, the little teal dots, those are areas where the costs for development are higher than the residual land value. So that's not financially feasible. So if you look at the table on the right-hand side, where you see oranges and reds, those are areas where the costs for infrastructure are higher than the residual land value. So it's not financially feasible. It would cost too much to put the infrastructure in to those areas for the value of development of those areas.
That's based on market rates for the land that are
We didn't show it all here. We did do a work session with the city council. I think you were actually on that one, Spencer. You were out of town, where I showed a whole lot more information on this topic. And so what we did for each of those different housing types, multifamily, hillside, low density residential, you go down the list, we came up with basically best case scenario for a developer in terms of what they could sell them for, based on the interviews we had with the development community. Because if they can't sell a best case scenario, they're not going to be able to do that type of development at all. And so we actually have the numbers. I can share that information with you about what those price points were.
Okay.
But the way this resonates with me is that, hey, look, to do that development and still have a reasonable profit margin, recognizing all that infrastructure cost, if that diamond's way high, like you have on 1A through 1D, there won't be enough money left over to buy the land. They can't do the project because we can't peg what the land values are. That's very hard to do, especially with raw land. But what you could do is you can interview and you can say, okay, if it's going to cost us X to build the product we want to, and Y for all of the infrastructure it's going to take to support it, and we have that much of a gap, we're not going to have enough money left over to buy the land, and so we're not going to do the project. If, like you have it's really close, then hey, maybe through some strategic investments in infrastructure, we can make it more attractive for those areas to develop.
So like areas 5, area 6, those are some of, and area 8 are some of your most financially feasible for development, the most attractive. And I'll make a disclaimer that I don't have any investments in land in Wilder or anything like that.
Yeah, another way to look at that too is when you think about it, with infrastructure, some of the most significant costs are the wastewater lift stations and the water pump stations. We have that infrastructure in place in Wilder, so it's much easier for the developer to deal with transportation cost, which is, extending the road, constructing gravity, sewer, water main extensions, but not absorbing the cost of a $3 million wastewater lift station. I mean, when you throw a major capital piece like that in, it really drives things up, and that's why you see such the big difference up in the Aggie Beach area, because we don't have that type of infrastructure up there. That's why I believe Area 3 would have been a problem, if it should. Not quite as bad.
Is Wolf Tree forever a resort? I mean, it could be resort.
I think where the state of Oregon is going to come down on it is if we're going to, how are we going to serve it if it's not a destination resort? Because the whole model for the destination resort was that it's all or nothing. You have a full commercial with your transient housing build out, and they put in their own wastewater treatment plant. We have no way to serve it. We can't get to the airport, let alone that far south. And so, nor does our wastewater treatment plant have capacity for it. So, you know, never say never, but you have real significant service constraints down there unless you do the destination resort model.
So I'm going to go on from this, unless you guys want to continue talking about this. I want to make sure that we get to one or two of the important things. All right, next slide, please.
This hasn't been important.
No.
No, this is important, but the other things are important also. So this part, next slide, please. Land sufficiency. So there's a forecast of population growth from the state, from PSU. That's for 248 people, resulting in 115 new households. That forecast is the official forecast. We have set that one aside and said, we are not going to use that. We are going to use the forecast that assumes that Newport grows at about the same rate that it's grown since 2010. That's not your official forecast, but we're using it anyway here because you guys aren't looking at an urban growth boundary expansion. So that results in growth of about 626 new dwelling units over the next 20 years. This part and the next couple of parts are to answer the question of, do you have enough land to accommodate this? The answer is yes, you've got enough land, but there's all kinds of interesting buts after that. So if we go to the next slide. So those 626 new dwelling units, what kind of new housing would you need based on information about the existing mix of housing, the kind of housing that's been developed in Newport over the last decade or so? And what we came to is, let's say that 50% of new housing might be single family detached and all the rest some other form of attached housing. Then that would be, that would assume that a lot more of the growth in Newport over the next 20 years is going to be these attached housing types that are more likely to be affordable comparatively than single family detached. If we go to the next slide. So if we look at all of your land that has that is vacant and that has capacity for new housing, then you have about, I think it's about 6,000 some odd dwelling units of capacity. Here what we're showing instead is the capacity on land that is not within the constructability analysis, because about half of Newport's land wasn't. And the land in the constructability analysis that we just looked at that was financially feasible, so areas like Area 5 are included in this estimate of capacity that results in about 3,800 dwelling units of capacity. So that likely still overstates Newport's land capacity for development without major, major infrastructure investments. And it may overstate it by half, but it you know, it's probably like Newport currently has about 2,000 dwelling units of capacity. You're going to need some infrastructure investments, but they aren't these extreme, you know, $37 million infrastructure investments. We're assuming 626 new housing units over the next 20 years. Is that an overestimate or an underestimate? Even if it's a little bit either way or some either way, you've got enough land to accommodate housing growth. So the issue isn't that you have a UGB problem. The issue is that you've got an infrastructure problem and an affordability problem.
Can you hit them with what UGB means?
Yes, urban growth boundary. I apologize. So you've got enough land in the urban growth boundary, but you don't have enough infrastructure, and who has enough money to pay for all that infrastructure anyway? And you've got some pretty big affordability problems. These are the subjects that are more important in your housing production strategy. That's what I'm trying to get to. And I think the last two slides, so the next slide, please, is will the forecast of growth fully address Newport's unmet housing needs? So even if you got 626 new dwelling units, will it address Newport's existing unmet housing needs? The answer is no. Your vacancy rate is about half what a healthy vacancy rate for a healthy housing market is. Newport and the entire state have, over the last decade and a little bit more, underproduced housing by hundreds of 100,000 or more units. That's the whole state, not just Newport. So you've got underproduction of housing. You've got existing high rates of cost burden, indicating that a lot of households cannot afford housing. About 70% of people who work in Newport live somewhere else, places like Toledo or unincorporated Lincoln County. Not all of those people, even if they could afford housing in Newport, would probably want to live in Newport, because some people prefer, maybe Toledo is their home where they have their family, or maybe they prefer living in a rural area. But a chunk of those people, if there was housing that was more affordable in Newport, would probably prefer to live in Newport. Over the next 20 years, Newport needs growth of a lot more multifamily housing than 157 units in the forecast. So one of the things to consider, and this is getting back to your question here, how has housing price grown relative to income? Has it gotten a lot less affordable? The answer is, oh my gosh, yes, it's gotten a lot less affordable. So since 2000, incomes adjusted for inflation grew by about 1%. So your incomes were flat, essentially. Even if we unadjust them for inflation, then it's just a few percent of loss, negative growth. Your sales prices since 2016 to December 2021 grew by 96%. They doubled. So incomes have stayed the same over the last two decades. Sales prices over the last 5 or 6 years doubled. Rent prices since 2011 grew by a quarter, maybe a little bit more than that. So you've got incomes like that, rents like that, and sales prices like that. So you just have enormous growth in housing costs and not enough growth in incomes. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, more or less.
Sure. Okay.
I think just on
it's Bob's, bad, I guess, yeah. Certainly.
And Bob's point there, too, the new president at Oregon Coast Bank indicated that in the last year, they've seen an increase of 20% in housing values, and then with the interest rates
increasing,
that the net cost for someone buying that same house a year ago to this year is actually 60% higher. If they had the mortgage, if it's a conventional mortgage, and that's just a scary, scary
thing. It is 60% higher or 16%?
60.
Now remember that this is going to be over a 20-year period, so interest rates were low for a very, very long time. Presumably, at some point here, I'm not going to try to predict when because I'll be wrong, interest rates will decline again. Will they get to as low as they had been in the next 20 years? And would it stay as low as they had been? Well, that was a historic low for a really long time. So the interest rates are just compounding an already big problem.
So the question on the affordability numbers, is any of that factored into affordability as far as what the estimate of mortgage rates were, or is it strictly looking at the value of the house versus income?
It was looking at the value of the house versus.
Okay, not how much it might be to borrow money to buy the house.
Yeah, no. No.
Can that be factored in any way?
I think it can be noted, certainly. But since we're talking about a 20-year period, really predicting what incomes are going to do or mortgage rates are going to do is difficult. But I think having a finding about increases in interest rates making it much harder to afford housing is certainly a reasonable thing to do.
And that's particularly true with the lower income, the mid income, and most people have to borrow money to buy a house, and so that was just a scary number that you shared with us.
Yeah. So then let us go to the next slide.
Could I?
Yes, sir.
One thing on this previous slide jumped out at me, and I'm not sure exactly how it. Maybe you could talk about how it's factored in. These 70% of workers,
yep.
Some significant portion of those would love to live in Newport. We all know that. We all hear the stories of even fairly high-level professionals coming and not being able to find a place to live in Newport. So this, the forecast growth in population, does that take into account this pent-up demand of these people that work here? But can't live here?
I don't think so, no.
So the demand is ultimately, if we did the 626 units tomorrow, they would be sucked up within a week. And
I think you're right.
We'd still have that population growth coming over the next 20 years.
We are going to try to make sure that in this analysis, there's at least a frame of how underwater we are right now.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's
and that it's very clear that the 626 has to do with a projected additional need over the next 20 years, not where we're at right
currently.
Now.
And that's what I was going to go to on the next slide, please. And so what this shows is the number of new people in those income categories, and if we figure in the same percentage of that 626 that's in the teal, that would be the additional new households. So basically, you've got about 1,900 existing and new households with income that is below 50% of median family income. Almost all of these households are cost burdened. We saw that on one of the earlier slides with low-income households being very, very cost burdened. Newport isn't going, it's like not likely over the next 20 years that you're going to see 1,900 new dwelling units that are affordable at those income ranges. There's just not enough money at the state to build that kind of housing in Newport, since other places need this kind of housing as well. On top of that, these households, they have housing units. So you're not going to replace all of your housing that for households that are cost burdened. But could we be talking about, beyond the 600, a couple of hundred additional households, there being that kind of demand? Certainly. And so the question ends up being one of, how much funding is available from the state, and what can the city do to support development of this kind of housing, both in that lower group and that middle income group. So there's really more demand than can reasonably be met. And that's actually true in a lot of our cities across Oregon. And I had one or two other slides, but I can skip those. They're the next step slides for questions, because we seem to have about 6 minutes.
So without subsidies, it's hard to build anything.
Yep.
Even for high income. High income? And $69,000 doesn't buy much these days.
No, it doesn't buy much at all. And of course, you've got a second home. I don't know if I'll call it a problem, but you've got a second home market here.
Yeah,
say that.
A big one, yeah.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. So I think part of some of the questions in the housing production strategy are geographic, and they aren't for me to answer, certainly, and they may not be for the committee to answer, but to pose to the city council for future decisions on where you put investments I think that there's a real geographical part of that. If you're away from the ocean or along, you know, one of the highways, those may be better places for those kind of investments, just because they're less desirable as second homes rather than, you know, beautiful over the overlooking of the ocean cliffs or something like that, which are more likely to be where second homes are. So
no, that's going to change pretty soon. We have a pretty rapidly retreating coastline here.
Yeah, indeed.
There'll be more like water.
Sorry, Bob. So in terms of next steps real quick, you know, coming out of this work session, the planning commission will have an opportunity to...
Next slide, please.
It's on that.
We'll it is on that.
Opportunity to initiate the legislative process by motion, which then we would then provide the state 35-day advance notice prior to the first hearing, which would be before the planning commission. That would be one of your January meetings. And so this would come to you for adoption, you, the city council, excuse me, probably late February, early March for adoption. And it'll be a pretty basic ordinance that adopts this. And the message it's sending to the state is what we've talked about tonight. That ordinance will pull out some of the specific policy implementation measures we currently have in our comprehensive plan, because they're going to land in the housing production strategy, which you will see at a later date. The state is pushing that direction because the housing production strategy, unlike this, does not have to be adopted by ordinance. It's not technically a land use document. You end up, as a council, have more flexibility in terms of how you can adjust housing policies, and they can't necessarily be used as a hammer by somebody who doesn't want to see housing projects move forward. So that's the state's reasoning for taking policy out of the comprehensive plan and putting it into a more flexible housing production strategy document that's adopted by resolution. So next step on this, this technical document moves forward, and you'll have kind of a basic adoption ordinance there that then simplifies kind of the structure in our comprehensive plan, recognizing a housing production strategy will follow.
Thank you.
So we're looking at an ordinance in February?
On this, yeah, February. Late February, probably early March.
Then what are you talking about changing by resolution?
That'd be adopting by resolution. It'd be a house. It's called the housing production strategies, what we're putting together. That'll probably get to you late summer, early fall.
So Derek, is that a gatekeeping device for state and federal grants to put down money if those grants are won towards a big multifamily project, or is it, does it grease the wheels? I mean, what?
Yeah, both documents can be used to secure state and federal money for housing projects.
But I wouldn't say they're gatekeepers.
I don't know. No, there are other factors, you know, agencies like Oregon Housing Community Services consider, but having accurate information and a clear policy path forward is going to make us more competitive.
And the fact that the city has skin in the game already and may have more skin in the game, and by that I mean things like the multi-unit tax exemption. There's things that the city is doing to support development of some of these more affordable housing types. That's actually a slightly bad example. But those kind of things, I think, do make Newport a little bit more competitive, at least.
Let me ask a question to Derek another way real quick.
Yeah.
I want to earn the taxpayers back this money we spent on the study. So where would that come into play when we get a federal or state match or for a future project?
Well, in part, earning it back for the taxpayer is to use these policies to generate more housing on the ground.
Right.
And so if these are effective at guiding policy that leads to more housing, we've done a good job. And so, you know, some of that might be securing money from state and federal sources for subsidized housing. Some of that may be informing how, as an urban renewal agency, you make investments in infrastructure to support additional housing, where we can use urban renewal funds. Some of this may be tax incentive programs that we adjust. Some of this might be forming a regional land banking, you know, a authority with partners like Lincoln County and Lincoln City. So there are a number of different ways this can go, and it should actually be a multi-pronged strategy. But as long as it's providing good policy advice and direction backed up by good data, then it's going to be useful information.
But we have to get your planning commission.
Yeah, we have a bunch of folks out in the hallway.
Yeah, what about second story housing? Is that considered at all here?
Yeah, residential over first floor, right. Commercial, if that's what you're referring to.
Yeah.
Certainly, and I would expect in the housing production strategy to be policies that direct where that should happen and how that should happen.
But that doesn't show up on any of the maps, does it?
Not specifically, because it's really kind of hard to do that with commercial.
Okay. All right, we'll have to end this, and we've got to start a planning commission meeting, so.
Yeah,
thank you.